Good morning. This is the Real Estate for Breakfast podcast. I'm your host, Philip Coover, a partner in Ice Miller's Real Estate Group. Today we have David Haig, Executive Vice President and Principal with NAI Hifman. David, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Phil. Thank you for inviting me.
You're one of our rare two-timers club.
I should get a jacket, a green jacket club.
Yeah, we got Rob Walters, Colin Leitner, Bob Cavoto. We've had a few, but here you are making the rounds. David was my, I think it was sixth episode, but he's back for more, and we've come a long way since then. But David, you're a broker. You're in the industrial space. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your company, you, what you do, kind of set the stage for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Phil. You know, NAI Hifman has been around for over 20 years. It started out many years ago as, a brokerage when it split off from HSA, which is more of a developer. Over the last number of years, it's been really exciting as we've kind of rebranded into the Hifman National for the property management division that we have here. So a lot of people have been seeing our signs and have seen a lot of the press and a lot of LinkedIn coverage on the big push on Hifman National, which is the property management component. I'm a broker. That's my kind of main job every day. So I work, I spend about half my time with either property owners or industrial landlords in the marketplace and, someone trying to sell a building. And then I spend about half my time with tenants or folks who are looking to purchase or lease buildings. Occupiers, I guess, is the new trendy buzzword that folks are starting to use now. My business is pretty straightforward. For those of you listening to the podcast who might be driving down the interstate, you see a big sign up that says, for lease on a large industrial warehouse in metropolitan Chicago. Could be, an NAI Hifman sign that you might see. Could be me, David Haig, or some of my team members here. One of the really kind of fun things about this business that I appreciate is, I got into this right around 2005. So I was able to see kind of the golden years before the Great Recession. So it was kind of an interesting time to have gotten in the business. You get in, it takes a couple of years to really be someone that, a 53-year-old decision maker will listen to when you're talking about, industrial real estate decisions. And it takes a little bit of time to learn what's going on. And then we had a very large correction in the marketplace in, 2008, 2009. My joke, Phil, is that for me, it was actually in hindsight, it was a good time to have gotten into the business because I was learning when everyone was kind of making money and things were moving along quite well. So I got to see all of that. But then the recession came and, a lot of people, left the business or didn't make much money for a while. I just kind of stayed broke, remained broke for a while. And then, throughout the 2010s and teens, we were able to find a lot of opportunities that come from those types of market corrections. And that's one of the things that I'd like to kind of stand on a soapbox here and kind of say to some of the younger folks who might be listening, who might be experiencing, a real estate correction for the first time in their careers. This is one of the things I say to some of the younger folks that are working here at NAI Hifman. It's like, hey man, opportunities come when markets correct, right? So, suddenly someone who might not have been a buyer will emerge and say, wow, finally pricing is adjusting and it's moving downward. And, now I can actually buy something as a user because the last few years have been so frothy and all the investors have been purchasing buildings. So, kind of always pay attention that sometimes these types of corrections can really lead to big opportunities. And, you got to stay positive and you got to work, keep on working forward and trying to uncover where that next opportunity might come from. But, your line of business will have to adapt compared to what it was before, a major market correction.
Yeah, that's right. And there's been a lot of movement over the past couple of years. Why don't you take us through how everything's gone for you and NAI in the market since 2020? Because it's been probably a little bit of a roller coaster, not all bad. but just a lot of different movement and changes in terms of the users and online shopping and distribution. And just tell us what you've seen.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was so interesting is now everyone kind of in the collective culture, you know, understands that there's like a pre-COVID, post-COVID kind of world or existence or experience for all of us. I think one of the interesting things is that in the late, you know, 20 teens, 17, 18, 19, these time periods back then, we had recovered from the Great Recession, and it was just this slow, steady kind of rise in terms of, you know, economic conditions. And, you know, back then, Phil, everyone used to talk about innings, remember? It was like almost as bad as like now everyone says pencils down. And you're like, when was the last time you even picked up a pencil? But anyway, back then, everyone would be like in the 2018 or 2019, like, I don't know what inning it is, Bill. You know, it's like, oh, we're in the seventh inning. You know, everyone had these little analogies about what, oh, I think we're in the fifth inning, you know, and it's like no one knew where we were. And suddenly COVID hits and all of us are like, wow, because if you actually go back to kind of that March of 2020, I think all of us in commercial real estate understood this is going to be an interesting little adventure we're going to embark upon. And for those of us who've been around longer, someone like myself, who has had these types of experiences, you go, hey, man, I'm not going anywhere. So let's just see how this thing shakes out. It's going to make for great stories in the future. But for now, it's a little scary. And my partner, Nick Fesco, who I'm working with on many of my transactions, actually started January of 2020. So he was a solid 3 months in with me. And he got to experience this like a punch in the face. But when that initially happened, the first, you know, 30, 60, 90 days of COVID lockdowns, those of us in all commercial real estate, I mean, everything just kind of froze, right? Like, whoa, what's going on here? How is this going to affect, you know, our lives? What's happening? And we were in a kind of a unique situation. And one of the things that I think was really important, and I'm sure someone like Sarah Canella, who was on this podcast that works at HIFA National, who's a great teammate of mine here, she might be able to correct these numbers. So allow me to kind of wing it here. But it was like,
no fact checking,
you know, yeah, no fact checking needed. It was something along these lines that the property management company would talk to us about, who's actually paying their rent. So you go like April 1, May 1, June 1. And again, kind of making up these numbers, but it was like 10% of retailers are paying their rent. Okay, maybe it was 20, you know, whatever. Of office folks, everyone's working from home, everything else, like 60% are paying their rent. You know, and then it's like industrial, 90% are paying their rent. Because guess what? If you need to get toilet paper so everyone can hoard, like that's coming from a warehouse, right? If you're going to order stuff online, where's that all coming from? It's coming from warehouses. And everyone was kind of pivoting to more online ordering, these types of things. And we'd all heard about it for years that eventually more people are going to order things like toilet paper and paper towels online. And we all kind of didn't really believe it. Like, you know, older folks, the senior citizens, I'll lump my parents in there. Suddenly they're like, yeah, this Target.com sure is great. You know, like it works. I guess I don't have to drive over there and go there twice a week or once a week or whatever. I can kind of get some stuff ordered and then go in every so often, that kind of thing. So what we saw was after about 90, 120 days, you know, all of us kind of peeked our heads up and we said, in the industrial section, we said, look, it seems like we're going to be all right. Like some of our companies are like, hey, I need more warehouse space. And, you know, we need more space. We're getting a lot of orders for a lot of the logistics and things like that. Some of the manufacturers were a little more hesitant to kind of move forward, but a lot of the warehousing, logistics, distribution folks, we're definitely looking kind of for more space. And so that, and I think I think it's kind of undeniable that we have to say that the one thing that really worked well during that time period was the PPP loans. A lot of people were not laid off. They were paid to kind of be at home. And when people are paid to be at home and it's a pandemic and you can't go out and spend your money, they're ordering things online. And so that created a situation where many, many, many people were ordering many, many more things. And it got so frothy that, you know, there were all these supply chain issues. I mean, that was what really kind of created a mad dash for most of corporate America, in my opinion, to say, hey, you know what, we need, okay, we've got 500,000 square feet of warehouse space sprinkled around the country, but let's order more stuff. So maybe we need like 750, maybe we need 800,000 square feet, you know, maybe we need more space. So let's lease another warehouse, or let's use this 3PL to hold some more of our inventory, because we're starting to see that there's some supply chain issues, and the products, because of COVID, are having difficulty, you know, in places like China, lockdowns, and all around the world. There were some slowdowns. So it kind of created a little bit of a hoard mentality, at least in my opinion. And there were plenty of industrial developers, and there was a lot of capital that was willing to go into developing new speculative construction to accommodate that need. The challenge is that it takes 18 to 24 months from conception or land site identification to having a building that's up and operational, and you can lease to a tenant and have a tenant operational in there. So it definitely takes some time. And in a crazy way, the supply chain issues actually hindered what would have been an absolute explosion of speculative construction. Like, what we were able to build in 2022 and 2023 was limited by the amount of precast panels that the developers could get. So it was this crazy, paradox is the wrong word. It was a situation where the supply chain issues facing corporate America were creating a demand for more buildings, and then the buildings can't get built because of the supply chain issues that are affecting corporate America. So we had a little bit of a cap, but I mean, I think that were there no building supply issues and challenges, we could have even seen more speculative construction than actually occurred. So we had record deliveries in 2022, 2023. And then of course the Fed started raising interest rates. And so that started happening. Let's just say late, you know, mid to late 2022, because of the inflation issues. When there's so much demand and everyone needs precast panels, guess what? The cost of precast panels go up, right? When everyone needs roofing materials, when everyone needs HVAC equipment, when everyone needs all these things, steel, just to build these industrial buildings, the pricing goes up. So, you know, we could kind of see in real time all of the inflation that was occurring. And it was really kind of an interesting time. You just, as a broker, and if you're working with a developer to take down a land site, buy a land site, and then lease the building, there was a time period where anything that was built was basically leased within, you know, 3 to 6 months. And then, you know, with the kind of tightening of, the raising of interest rates by the Fed, which if you would have interviewed me in 2022 and you would have said, hey, what's going to happen if you were to increase interest rates like 300 basis points, I would have said, whoa, it's going to be a major shock. It's going to be crazy. But what kind of has ended up happening, at least in industrial real estate, it just kind of turned the spigot of capital off. And so now what we're seeing is construction deliveries going way down because the capital is more judicious or more discerning in where they're willing to invest. And we're seeing fewer deliveries coming forward. And that's kind of where we're at on the new construction side. So I went on like a really long narrative there, but that's awesome. Kind of what's been going on for the last 3-4 years.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was like a walk down memory lane. Like, I'm thinking about, as you're talking about this, funny thing quick is my wife always talks about, she won't watch pre-pandemic comedy, stand-up. We love stand-up comedy in our house. But she's like, no, the world changed. Like, yep. I don't want to hear someone's jokes from 2017 because the world was totally different. And at first I thought that was like, kind of like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, the world did change. And there's a lot when you think about it phrased that way. So I thought about that as you talked about the world changed. But then, you know, 2 years ago, we were in my practice talking to developers all the time about the supply chain issue and how they would have to put deposits down on steel or HVAC units way before they were otherwise normally be comfortable putting down those deposits and reserving those materials. But I simply don't hear people talk about that. As maybe it's still happening, maybe it just became part of our practice, but you're right though. We don't seem to be having the supply chain issues, and maybe more relatably, you know, for there's a period of 2 years where everyone in suburban America was worried about how long their kitchen renovation was going to go because they had to reserve their refrigerators 2 years in advance. ABT was very, very busy for a couple of years there. I don't hear about that as much as plenty of other construction development problems out there, but I don't hear about the supply chain materials as much anymore. And then I remember going to your charity event a year or two ago, Dave, where we were just worried about the banks lending on anything. Yeah. And, you know, knock on wood, we're recording this June 27th. So if a bank fails June 28th, don't blame David and I. But like, we haven't heard about the banks having that kind of systemic problems that it was having 6-12 months ago, where every couple of weeks another bank out of, you know, Silicon Valley, wherever, we're failing. So maybe that has stabilized and maybe the market has been able to absorb that increase in basis points that you point out. All that to say is I loved your walk down memory lane of the past 4 or 5 years. Thought that was very helpful. So where are we right now in terms of, let's say you represent a tenant and you're talking to a tenant in terms of their options and getting into new space or going with how are landlords treating renewals? Like, what are you seeing in the market right now?
Yeah, this is timely. We're working with a couple of different tenants. If it's all right, I'd like to maybe take a moment to talk about tenants and then talk about kind of landlord positions and maybe use them kind of interchangeably off of each other as I make up a little example here that heavily based on some of the stuff I'm working on right now. It really depends on the tenant, because what has happened is the net rental rates have gone up significantly since before COVID. There was an era, which now seems quaint, when and we'll go back like 20 years. There was an era when there would be private owners of industrial buildings. Maybe it would be, me, you, and Jack would form an LLC and we'd lease a building to a tenant. And that tenant's a good tenant. They pay their rent. You know, they even came out of pocket to replace a window over here, and they're good folks. And we would say, you know what, the renewal's time to come, you know, and they've been good. Like, we don't want to put it on the market, go through the hassle, pay the commissions and the legal and all this other stuff, you know, just to get an extra 50 cents or a dollar in net rent. Let's just cut a deal with these guys, give them a little free rent, you know, in exchange for them sticking around another 5 or 10 years. And that's a pretty pragmatic private investor approach. And it helps facilitate a goodwill feeling between, you know, the landlords and the tenants. Over the years, commercial real estate in general, and particularly industrial as an asset class, really industrial has become kind of the darling of the investor world. And there are fewer and fewer private landlords anymore. And they're almost all institutional owners or some sort of investor that has a fund and goes out and buys buildings. And their whole purpose is to aggregate a number of properties into a portfolio and then sell that portfolio to an even bigger owner. It's kind of in the business model. So what's happening is you have a tenant who might be a strong local company, great, healthy profit margins, been in business 40 years, you know, maybe have another location or two around the Midwest. And they're like, hey, we've been in this building for 8 years. But that past owner, that private group, you know, they sold it to a much larger institutional owner. And though the tenant, you know, has been taking care of the building and feels like there's a good relationship as they pay their rent every month, they feeling really good about that. Suddenly the landlord says to them, you know, hey, you're currently paying $5 net plus, you know, let's say $3 in operating expenses, so $8 gross, let's say. And cool. So now we're going to need you to pay $7.80 net plus $3.20. You know, it's a huge jump in net rental rates, because what has happened is just the entire asset class, everything is more expensive. Construction got more expensive. Acquiring all these buildings, doing the maintenance, all these things got very expensive, and they still remain pretty expensive. And so the landlords are saying, well, in order for us to meet our return, we're going to need you to pay what is quote unquote market today. And that is a really big kind of uppercut, hit to the chin for a lot of these smaller local tenants who might not be big enough to have that kind of ability to turn to their own customers and say, hey, you guys are going to have to pay us more for what you're getting now because we have to pay this rent, and this rent has gotten quite high. So if you're a smaller tenant, you know, you're really struggling with that because, yes, you could move. You could move to a less expensive submarket, but you're going to run into the other issue that you're facing, which is labor, right? So, you know, okay, you're let's say you're in O'Hare, but you're not really utilizing O'Hare Airport. You just happen to be occupying space in a 100 million square foot submarket. And you're currently paying, you know, $6 net, and suddenly your landlord comes back to you at $10 net and says, yeah, you're just coming off of a 10-year deal, and, you know, we'll lease it to you now at this much higher rate. You might say, oh, that's insane. I'm out of here. I'm going to move. But you're going to move. You have to move out to Elgin, or you're going to have to move out to like Aurora. You're going to have to move really far away. And then, gosh, that makes it really difficult to retain the employees, which are so important to your business, who are accustomed. You know, they might be coming from the city. They might be coming from the northern suburbs. And that's been a real big challenge. So, you know, I've been working with a number of tenants in this situation. One of them was in the Central DuPage submarket, and they decided to move out to Elgin to occupy space. They were able to get a slightly larger square footage in a newer building and, you know, pay about the same that they were paying previously in Central DuPage, whereas if they would have renewed with their landlord, it would have represented a 40% increase in what their occupancy costs were. So geographical flexibility is a big component with these tenants. Now, the larger corporate tenants, the bigger groups, they're just kind of taking it on the chin. You know, they're saying, hey, I want to be here. You know, hey, I'm a freight forwarder. I'm not going to leave O'Hare, right? Like, I got to be near that airport, and I'm going to have to pay what I have to pay in the market. So we are seeing, you know, kind of record-setting O'Hare net rents. And we're also seeing, though, this geographical arbitrage, which is the term that I kind of use, where, you know, folks used to say, I'm not moving. I want to be here. And then suddenly they go, well, I don't know, man. Maybe I don't want to be here that bad. It's gotten really expensive, and they'll look to, you know, other industrial pockets in the metro area. So that's what you have on the tenant side. And, you know, we're often also seeing, you know, the one of the biggest challenges is TI, right? So tenant improvements. It used to be that you could, if you're working with a 100,000 square foot user and they have, let's say they have 7,000 square feet of office. And, you know, you'd say, okay, you know, you're currently in 7,000 square feet of office. You know, what do you think? Well, we probably need like 8 because, you know, we might hire a couple more people in the next few years. So, okay, let's look. Let's do 120,000 square foot building with 8K of office. All right. It used to be you just go to the market and, you know, if there was a building that had, I don't know, 3,000 square feet of office, the landlord would just kind of say, all right, well, we'll put in that extra office. We'll make it work. Da-da-da-da. Unfortunately, the cost of those tenant improvements within, you know, a building shell has gotten really, really expensive. And it's like construction raised pretty significantly, construction costs, and they've just plateaued recently. They haven't like really gone down too much. Right. They've just kind of plateaued. So we're still talking pretty expensive pricing. And so now if you're working with that hypothetical tenant who needs 8,000 square feet of office and you go to a brand new spec building, you know, we use like kind of a rule of thumb. Maybe it's like $200 a foot, you know, for an office to be built entirely within a shell of a spec building. Well, that's $1.6 million, right? And so if your guy says, oh, you know, I want to do a 5-year deal, you're like, probably not going to happen. The landlord's going to want to see a long-term deal. But I don't want to lock into a long-term deal because net rents are high right now. Like, yeah, well, maybe we really need to dig into that office number. And do you need 8,000 square feet of office? How many employees do you have? How many conference rooms do you need? And so then we're starting to tighten up what the tenants actually need. Whereas it used to just be something you kind of blanketly say, yeah, we need 5K office. Now it's like, we have 33 employees, this many private offices are going to be needed, this many huddle rooms, this many conference rooms. You kind of get a little more granular on that. So someone can go, hey, you don't need 8,000 square feet of office. We can actually do it in 5,600. Look at this site plan. It kind of works. And so we're doing certain things to kind of try to cut some of the costs from these deals on the tenant rep side. On the landlord side, what we're seeing when we have these buildings up is that there was always a healthy, let's just say, I don't know, it's kind of like a fear of the next spec building grabbing the next logical tenant for your building.
Gotcha. Right?
So yeah. So when you're a developer, or when our developer clients are building a building, you know, they always, it takes 18 to 24 months to do this. They look around at the competitive set and they kind of know that the buildings that are currently available will have probably leased by the time, you know, by the time that this building's actually coming up. But one thing you can pretty much keep a, you know, finger on the pulse of is what's going to come after this speculative development has occurred. So since 2022, when the interest rates went up and the spigot of capital got basically closed, that was when everyone said, pencils down, and no one was doing any additional development. So the product that is currently delivering right now, a lot of it was put in motion prior to the increase in interest rates. So the stuff that's delivering today was really put in motion 18 to 24 months ago. But here's the thing. Very, very few developers got started 6 months ago, 12 months ago. So there's nothing behind it. It's not like, oh, I just built a 200,000 square foot building here. And oh, crud, I better lease this building. I better get more aggressive. Because I know there's two other buildings that are being built in this submarket by my competitors. And the last thing you want to do is build a spec building, have it be up, have it be vacant for 6 months. And the next deal that hits the submarket that would take a new spec building goes to the guy who's delivering in 3 months, right? Like that's the fear. Well, there's no competitive new product behind the stuff that's coming online today or that has come online in the last 6 months. So the landlords are holding more firm than they probably would be were there like a pipeline of development projects behind them. So we're in a situation now where the tenants are like, God, this thing's been up for a while and it's vacant. They don't have any tenants. You know, the economy's not screaming like it was in 2021, 2022. Why aren't they lowering their rental rates? And you're like, because overall in the total market, vacancy's still pretty darn low. So they might own like 12 million square feet in Chicago, and this is a 300,000 square foot spec building. And they're like, whatever, we're still like 98% leased. We're going to hold out until we get our number right now. So now we've got the situation where the tenants are going, all right, you know, what are we going to do here? And so there is this kind of a little bit of a slowdown in velocity of transactions, because there's a lot of tenants who are saying, well, I mean, if these things sit vacant for a little bit longer, maybe they could get more aggressive. And there's a lot of landlords who are like, nope, we're not dropping our rate. We're going to hit pro forma. And if you're not the tenant for us, then the next one will be. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out, but things are kind of quieter than they have been the last few years for I think these reasons.
Good time to enjoy some summer for you guys. Yeah.
A little
busy. So I was looking at the NAI office market report, which I would encourage people to look at. It's got a lot of great data, very easily accessible. I mean, it said something like you guys are less than 6% vacancy rate in industrial, which is radically different than you're seeing in office, obviously. But I imagine with that low vacancy rate, that does give landlords a lot of confidence to stay firm, at least for the time being, that they'll get somebody because it is pretty dramatically low.
Yeah, I mean, historically, we're still at very, very low vacancy. And another thing that I think is worth noting, because this has been seen in some other markets, you know, like some folks have, just kind of anecdotally speaking, you know, from what I've heard in the West Coast, there's more sublease activity there, you know, in the Inland Empire and in the industrial kind of warehousing space there, you know, there are more sublease opportunities there than there certainly are here in Chicago. One of the interesting kind of things is that because everyone's locking into 3, 5, 7, 10-year leases, when the economy changes, it's often hard to do anything. So we monitor, like as a tenant, you can't just like walk away from your leasehold obligation, right? You have to continue paying rent even if you're not utilizing the space. And so what tenants do when they've locked into a lease and then 3 years into a 10-year lease, their business changes dramatically, is often they'll put the space on the market for sublease, right? And we're not seeing a massive amount of sublease, which means that more companies are utilizing their space at a healthy kind of normal level. So yeah. I think overall the tenants are doing okay. There's certain segments that are being kind of hit worse than others. I think transportation right now is really, really getting hindered. There was a frenzy, and this is reflective in kind of the industrial outside storage world, which I believe is something that has been referenced on this podcast. You know, yeah. there's a lot of investors who have kind of mainstreamed what was a niche asset class within industrial, the industrial outside storage type of properties. And those are, you know, they're still being utilized by companies who need to store trucks, trailers, spools of wire, all sorts of things that you can't really put in a building. But, you know, that market has gone really soft because transportation is not doing that great right now. Like I said about, you know, some of the more local kind of 3P. Pardon?
Why do you think that is?
It was because it was so frothy. And this is, you know, armchair, you know, David, just top of the head thing. I think it was because it was so frothy in the supply chain kind of dominant, you know, the supply chain crunch time period that a lot of people staffed up, entered into leases in spaces, bought a lot of trucks, things like that. And then now things have kind of chilled out a bit. You know, the interest rate hikes have cooled things a little bit. It's a blunt instrument, but ultimately it's like, okay, it did cool things. We're not seeing 9% inflation anymore. At least I don't feel it when I go to the grocery store as much as I did a couple of years ago. You know, transportation is one of those kind of things that gets it, but it's all transportation has always been like pretty choppy business. And there are people who, you know, invest too much and take down, you know, larger spaces and are really posed for growth, and they can do quite well. And, you know, but then there's been some high level bankruptcies like the YRC bankruptcy and things like that have also shown that even the larger groups are not doing that great in transportation. So,
yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you about is just about 6, maybe 12 months ago, Amazon announced that they were kind of scaling back their need for warehouse space. Is my recollection? I should have Googled up some articles on this before I jumped on the podcast. It's just something I was thinking about. Like, how did you perceive that in your world in terms of the industry on the whole?
Yeah, I've leased two buildings to Amazon in my career, and it's very funny because they were like two of the smallest deals that Amazon did, right? So they weren't the million square footers that they're so well known for. But I think realistically that part of their strategy is to kind of right size and reposition their footprint. And I mean, this is just a pure guess from someone who has no real true inside knowledge. The deals I did with Amazon were a long time ago, and we certainly don't represent them in the marketplace. But one of the things that we noticed was that, you know, they might have, you know, facility A, you know, in half a building next to facility B, which is a medium sized building. And why don't we just put these in, you know, facility C, which is a million square feet, and find a way to make this work. So Amazon did, of course, when everyone pays attention to them, but I kind of feel like they were rapacious in their takedown of space. And really what they're doing is they're saying, all right, let's really study how we're utilizing various locations. And this might mean that we need to put out a press release because we're going to sublease 30 buildings around the country. You know, that seems like a big deal, but when you look at the square footage of what was being put on the market relative to, you know, the total amount of square feet that they leased, it was tiny, in my opinion. It wasn't big. And so it made a lot of noise and cranes and things like that. But I didn't see it as a serious issue. There have even been kind of rumors of spaces that they put on the market for sublease and might have consolidated in another building. And then a year later, they're like, all right, we're going to kind of go use that building again because we need some space. So that, of course, wouldn't really be reported or really talked about. So in my opinion, it makes sense for someone who has hundreds of buildings around the country to occasionally press the pause button and say, are we utilizing this space in a way that makes the most sense? We were given a mandate to grow. And maybe there's some efficiencies that we can find. To me, it's just Amazon being Amazon.
Yeah, right. No, that makes total sense. Thanks for your insight on that. One other thing I just want to talk to you about is just a lot of people like the urban infill. They're like going into the cities, but taxes are a problem. So, but you, I think, and your group have paid a lot of attention to 6B and what tax breaks and relief there is available in a more sophisticated way than many brokers do. And so I wanted to give you kind of the opportunity to talk about that. I think it's a real value add that you bring to your clients, your sophistication in that space. So tell us what you're seeing in terms of how much are people complaining about taxes? And I mean, always in Illinois.
But, yeah. I mean, that, right. Like it's kind of a local pastime here to complain about the state of
hot dogs and taxes. That's what we got.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the Cubs, the Sox and taxes. But one of the things that is interesting is there's a bit of a paradox. Everyone loves infill development and no one wants to develop in Cook County. Well, Cook County is where the infill development is. And therefore, it is super important to understand the programs that are in place to act as an economic development tool so that folks actually do develop in Cook County. And so Cook County has come up with what's called the Class 6B program. Basically, what it does is it reduces the assessed value of the property for 10 years, and then it starts to go up in years 11 and 12. And what's interesting about this is that a developer will procure a Class 6B tax abatement from the municipality. The municipality will approve it, but then it has to go to Cook County to be approved at the county level. And most communities for new construction in Cook County will approve the Class 6B because they want to use it to spur development. What would happen is the economics wouldn't pencil if they didn't use that tool, because what essentially the Class 6B does is that it brings the taxes down so it's comparable to the collar counties. Of all the counties in the state of Illinois, 99 of them operate, you know, their taxes in the same way, and then Cook County treats things differently. I would argue that they do differently is a bad thing in this situation. And what they do is they have much, much higher taxes. And it's a convoluted system and it requires tools like the 6B in order to get anything done. And one of the challenges that we've seen recently is communities are less interested in utilizing the Class 6B for other things that they have historically used the 6B for, which is renovations of buildings and vacancy. Vacancy hasn't been as big of a problem as it was in, let's say, the Great Recession time period. Back then, if you had a building that got vacant in Cook County, you'd literally wait 2 years and then you would lease the building receiving a Class 6B for vacancy. They shortened that down to about 1 year in the kind of 20 teens. So you'd be vacant for a year, you'd get a Class 6B, and then you'd lease up the building. We haven't had those vacancy levels in a long time. So this isn't really a big thing. There haven't been many vacancy approvals recently. But the renovation one is where you take a building and you say, hey, we're willing to stay here in this community and we're going to invest in this community by improving the building, maybe building more office, repositioning it, and our company's going to stay here for X years. And they go, okay, we'll give you a tax reduction for that investment in our community. We're seeing some of that. But the new construction is where it's critical, because if you're going to build a brand new building, that would be kind of new and it would be taxed at a high rate anyway. And then you add the Cook County, additional tax levels that they have relative to the collar counties. And you would just you'd be kind of underwater immediately as a developer. And the tenants, though they care about, you know, the gross rent, they just recoil at paying what is kind of an insane tax level. So in this situation, you have developers who, when the market is go, 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 and when the capital is flowing, and, you know, 2021, 2022, that we were just talking about earlier, they're willing to overlook the challenges of the future where the Class 6B is expiring, because that's, you know, a problem for the future. That's 10 years from now. And they're willing to go out, build a building, and then lease it for this 10-year time period. Cook County used to have what's called the renewal program for Class 6Bs. And that is something where right now it's kind of a coin flip in what community you're in within Cook County. It used to be that if you invested and you built a speculative building and you leased it to a company, you would then be able to go in year 9 and say, hey, we want to stay here for 10 years. However, if you don't give us this Class 6B program, if you don't extend it for another 10 years, this company is going to relocate. That was something that in a softer market where communities were worried about losing jobs and they were worried that maybe they already have a lot of vacant buildings in their town, they would be willing to entertain those renewals. Some communities still do the renewals, and it's great when they do. It retains companies, and really they're paying about the same as what they would pay in the collar counties in terms of taxes. But what's happening is that there's a little less pressure to approve those renewals now in Cook County. And there's a lot of concern coming from the assessor that there's going to be higher taxes for commercial properties, which includes industrial. And there's also a lot of worry in Cook County that because of the decimation in values we're seeing on the office in the Loop, that they're going to be looking around for someone else over the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years to increase taxes on. And it sure ain't going to be the residents, right? It's going to be on other commercial folks. And the fear is they start taxing higher on industrial buildings. This is all just what we talk about. We have, you know, extensive relationships with tax attorneys and folks who are experts in this subject matter as well, that we refer to our clients and we kind of dive in and we do the analysis on, you know, what it looks like if your property doesn't get the Class 6B renewed, and what it looks like if it does, and all these other things. We do a lot of that for our clients. And to your point, is a little subject area that I've worked on a lot over my career, and I've really been able to kind of help companies navigate, because it is very confusing.
Yeah. No, thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. These new Soldier Fields don't build themselves. You know, we got to generate this revenue somewhere. It's not from the office buildings.
But the point is, though, is that, like, people want to be, if Cook County had their act together, I mean, like, I'm not running for office here. I can just say what I'm feeling here. Like, if they get your act together and, you know, don't charge like an insanely high tax rate on these properties, and people want to be there. Like, if Cook County was like a super efficient, well-ran entity, then everyone would be like, awesome. They got labor. They got access to transportation. There's all sorts of great things going on in Cook County. It's just, the problem is that it's like, it's a $2 per square foot tax in, you know, Will County or DuPage. And without a 6B, you guys are at $6. It's like, come on, you know, like, get it, you know. So you need these programs. And that's kind of the challenge. People, business decision makers look at this and say, in 2 years, in 3 years, in 6 years, I'm pretty confident where Will County is going to be tax-wise. Yeah, you know, everything goes up. I'm pretty confident I know where DuPage is going to be. Cook? Cool. And so, look, I mean, that's my only, like I said, I don't think I'm going to ever run for assessor. So I'm not too stressed out about it. But I mean, to me, that's just the feedback from the business community. It's like, hey, guys.
I'm hearing that everywhere. It is partly the cost, but it's mostly the variability that they're having trouble wrapping their arms around. It's like, how do you plan for the future if you have no idea what it's going to be?
It's the uncertainty.
Yeah.
You know, because ultimately making a real estate decision, I like to say this to instill a sense of seriousness in maybe a junior broker, like it is a fireable like issue. If you mess it up, if you're a decision maker for a company and you're like, oh yeah, I just assumed the 6B would get renewed and now our taxes have quintupled, like, dude, bad decision, right? And so you really need to do your best to help your clients who are navigating through these issues. You got to do your best to help lay out the options and the scenarios and the best case and worst case and let them make the decision. Because they might say, some companies might say, yeah, I know, but we have a lot of engineers here. We're going to spend $20 million on machinery and we've got this great labor base. And though we don't like it, you know, maybe we're willing to take that risk that we don't get the 6B renewed, but thank you for letting us know what the challenges are so we can present it and make sure that we're making a decision that's best for our company. And so you want to make sure that you're trying to lay out the options for the client to the best extent you can.
I love it, David. I'm going to let you get out of here on that. Making your real estate decision is a fireable offense. I love that. But thank you very much.
Hiring a bad broker is a fireable offense. So put my contact information in the show notes and maybe I'll get a phone call from someone.
That's exactly right. All right, David Haig, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Anytime you need someone to talk at you for 40 minutes, tell you everything that he's popping into his head about industrial real estate, I'm here.
I've been enjoying it for 35 years and growing.
This publication is intended for general information purposes only and does not and is not intended to constitute legal advice. The listener should consult with legal counsel to determine how laws or decisions discussed herein apply to the listener's specific circumstances.